All right. I think the audience needs to understand something about my relationship with this show. That I'm in a very unhealthy, codependent relationship with the third rail. You know, not, to say nothing of the fact that the amount of times that Spectre has left the show, and I still take him back. The producing the show gives me a weekly aneurysm. I think a lot of people don't know that, but what I think they don't know is just the level of nonsense I have to deal with you. I checked my phone the other day to find like half a dozen voice messages from this guy, and I think people need to hear these.
Note to self. Shark. No. Note to self. Dead body to water ratio. Metaphor. Yeah, I know it sounds stupid to anybody listening, but it'll make me remember what I was thinking just now. The word for palindrome should be a palindrome. And the word for what an onomatopoeia is should sound like a word that sounds like a word for the thing that sounds like a word. Yeah, I'm going to go with that. You know, I haven't had it in probably 30 years, so as I'm driving, I'm wondering why my hands smell like fiddle faddle.
It's those two assholes. Those two idiots you saw me talking to at the third rail.
Just he doesn't want to touch the third rail.
That is the third rail, saying white people have interest.
Third rail. Third rail here is another wonderful show on our TRS network.
And it's the third rail. You will be destroyed.
It's the third rail. You will be destroyed.
Watch out for the third rail, baby. That's high voltage.
And the opinion of this reporter, if this nation or, in fact, the world ever needed heroes, that time is now. That time is now.
Ask the Romans. Buildings just happen to collapse for no reason whatsoever. This is happening. It is episode 204. 204, the most huggable, you know, you guys are lucky. It's a holiday weekend. We're giving you content. I ain't going to write everything out. But we've been on air since 1973, the third rail. We are coming to you almost live during this, the American birthday event to grill. Hi, how are you, Inspector? How are you, Borzoi and Nikkei? What are you doing, guys, doing up?
I feel like I got to shout this out. Spectre, more like Spectrum.
I'll allow it.
Is fiddle faddle boomer slang for sex? Like, I don't know what that is.
No, it's like,
But I know you said you didn't have any in 30 years, so I can only assume.
It's a Cracker Jack. It's like, let me, yeah. I need to relate to these young people. Let me reference something that, let me reference freaking Cracker Jacks.
I don't know.
So is fiddle faddle like something from the 1870s and Cracker Jacks something like from the 1920s? Is this the reference I'm trying to pick up here?
I'm gonna hurt you, Loretta. Don't make me do it.
If he's my audio warning that signs of early onset dementia, reach out to help with a care provider for your loved one.
Well, if this makes you feel better, Spectre, Mephilus 78, I guess that's his age, knows that fiddle faddle is cheap Cracker Jacks. Uh-oh, somebody's not happy right now. I think I need to go mute myself, so I'll let you guys carry things for right now.
Oh, that's going to be rough, because I know that my audio is a little bit rough. I'm having flashbacks for recording during the 2019 year of the road trip. But, yeah, I'm traveling to just a little weekend celebration, you know, a little get-together. Nikkei, what do you got going on? Anything fun for the holiday weekend?
Yeah, I have plans to go see some R guys tomorrow. Going to go have a cookout, a barbecue, and if any of you listening haven't been invited to a party with R guys in it, what are you doing? You need to get involved. You need to find a pool party, and you need to get vetted, because I promise you, if you're listening, you're one of us, and you're in the United States, you would have been invited to a party. But instead, you're going to have to sit around and talk to normies at whatever, like, boomer party you're getting invited to. Instead of talking to cool people that relate to you and want to be your friend.
Yeah, you've got to be the Wojak over in the corner at the normie.
They don't know how racist I am. My feet hurt.
I'm doing something similar in a different area. I mean, we're all over. That actually relates to one of the topics I have, but we're going to save that stuff for later. What I said in one of those messages, I was actually serious about the dead body to water ratio. Like, obviously, you would not get into a bathtub with a dead body, nor would you swim in a swimming pool.
Where the hell are you going with this?
But you would swim in the ocean, which has dead bodies.
Where there are certainly tens of thousands of dead bodies. So there is some point where the water to dead body ratio is acceptable to you.
Interesting. No, that's actually a totally valid point. I think, I don't know. You know, Lake Superior, that's fine. What's the smallest body of water? Maybe a pond. And like you knew about it.
And also, I guess it would depend on the age, like how long ago it was.
Well,
like a small pond, but it was like 50 years ago. Yeah.
Well, do you know about it as well? I mean, that's critically important. The ocean, you can just assume because it's the ocean.
Exactly. That's what I'm getting at.
All right. Borzett has traded
me. Nothing to do with anything.
Yeah. Borzett has traded my son for some sausage and eggs.
Or you could be in India and swim in the Ganges as dead bodies float by.
For those with degenerate minds in the live audience, that was Borzoli tapping the back of his son. No one was fapping during the intro.
I realized that's Hope's. I didn't realize I was picking
disgusting
that up.
Disgusting people. Disgusting.
Yeah, you're ridiculous. Borzoli's like, hey, I'm real busy real quick. I'll be right back. I've got to take care of something.
I'm just honoring Jeffrey Toobin in solidarity with him.
Toobin moment.
You Toobin.
Okay, so now in hindsight, this is going to be the quickest 180 I've ever done. What? I was now berating audience members for having degenerate minds for thinking that, and now that I think about it in hindsight, especially with you jumping off, I gotta go take care of something.
It's just so no. Even if the audience member understood, because his baby was crying when he went on mute. Pointing it out was very funny because like interrupting yourself like as you're unmuted. I'll be right back.
Just call me Jeffrey. Just call me Jeffrey Borzubin.
couldn't be bothered to wait a minute to excuse yourself. You had to start live on air.
We desperately need a good show title for today because I don't want today's title to be Jeffrey Borzubin.
I already wrote it down.
I heard you typing, and that's what made me terrified.
I didn't pick up on that.
Let's just keep it kind of slack. No particular format today since it is a holiday weekend.
I have topics, but I don't have winners or losers.
Yeah, kind of similar. And then I was recalling that last year at this time we kind of went into the holiday weekend equally unprepared and came out with some of the most amazing on-air discoveries regarding hot dog eating contests.
I feel like that was 2 years ago. I could be mistaken, though, but I feel like that was 2 years ago. Was it last year? Was the 6 million hot dogs last year?
I'm almost 100% sure because I was picturing that I knew exactly where I was when I was recording that one. And that would have been 2020.
Okay. Yeah. All the episodes blend together for me.
I got a question.
Well, now I can't. Okay, I was just seeing something in the chat. Now I can't pronounce your name as anything but Bourgeois. But I'll never see your name as anything else than that now.
Would you rather have like an excellent, amazing hot dog or like a okay to good burger?
Well, Considering hot dogs are Jewish, I'm going to go with the burger.
I'll go with the burger because of the implication.
I like a good hot dog, so I'll take the excellent hot dog over the good.
I thought you were about to do like some kind of version of the hot stuff copy. But I like a good burger.
Oh no!
I've had some good burgers in my time.
You can find that in many places.
Yeah, you can find Jewish deep dives into American foods at a number of different places.
It's growing, like I said, like the article, one of the articles that I pulled up had to say, despite everything, despite the constant 24/7 propaganda. Do you have that Vice story up?
Oh yeah, I can pull that up right now. Let's just go ahead and start with that.
Can you read?
Oh, I also, so this was from last year, and I think we didn't cover this, but I might have some an audible here on four Jewish facts for the 4th of July.
Oh, okay.
So I think I might do that one later, but I got your here it is right here. Let me get that set up on OBS here.
Number there one Jewish fact of 4th of July, America.
Well, I'll read it in a moment. But here you go. A disturbing number of Americans have right wing authoritarian views, from Vice News by Paul Blessed,
who I did a very quick background check on. There's no obvious early life, but when you see somebody has written it, you know, disproportionately about how things affect Jews, you can pretty much guess.
Yeah. Oh, he just did a new article about J.D. Vance is deleting all his anti-Trump tweets. Man, they are really, like, they're really working on this J.D. Vance angle. Go ahead and take it away, Spectre.
Oh, sure. I guess you should go ahead and have all the standard caveats, which is considering that it's coming from Vice News and somebody who's almost certainly Jewish, a writer at Vice News, what their definition of what right wing is, you have to take with a grain of salt, of course. But they are desperately wringing their hands, not rubbing their hands, wringing their hands. Because what they have discovered is that a disturbing number of Americans are politically inclined toward authoritarianism, according to new research released by Morning Consult. A survey used the right-wing authoritarianism scale developed by psychologist Bob Altermeyer. Anybody want to guess? Yay, nay?
Polynesian?
German.
I mean, I honestly don't know. But it seems pretty obvious. I'd say there's at least a better than 50-50 chance.
Just keep going. I have to do some prep work, so keep going.
Okay. The scale to compare the authoritarian tendencies among people in the U.S. and seven other countries, including Canada, Australia, and the United Kingdom. The scale ranges from least authoritarian to most authoritarian. Researchers found that 26% respondents in the U.S. were highly right-wing authoritarian. Which is, by the way, double the numbers in Canada and Australia.
Get fucked. Canada and Australia.
No kidding. But this just, you know, so let's just take as read their definition of right wing and right wing extremist. There it is. I mean, a quarter of Americans are just still, despite literally decades of constant propaganda, just not having it. They are worried. They have ground the stone down as far as it'll go, and I you know, they can't let their foot off the gas at this point. They are in a purity spiral as it is, well, with all the CRT stuff. But they have overplayed their hand in such great ways with the collapse of everything going on around us. This is just, you know, a wonderful thing. But I'll continue with the story, I guess.
I want to jump in here with a point. I don't know if it's ever been articulated before, but the way you just described it made me realize it's like this is why the physical racial replacement is so important. Because there is a ceiling to the effects of propaganda. And they're not satisfied with that, especially in America. Because they can't propagandize all of us, and their numbers are are particularly lackluster in the United States compared to other Anglophone nations, they have to just replace us with minorities, with the racial hordes.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's what it kind of comes down to. But I want to continue with this. Now, keep in mind this scale on which they measured people's opinions is referred to sort of as if this were some sort of scholarly tool by...
Like the F scale that they had for the authoritarian personality, that scientific scale.
Correct. So this is where it gets good in that sense. In his book, The Authoritarians, Altermeyer defined an authoritarian personality as being inclined towards submission to authority, an aggression on behalf of authority, and conventionalism. Altermeyer has long thought a significant minority of Americans were right-wing authoritarians. Probably about 20 to 25% of the adult American population is so right-wing authoritarian, so scared, so self-righteous, so ill-informed, and so dogmatic that nothing you can say or do will change their minds. He told the former Nixon White House counsel John Dean in 2006. They would march America into a dictatorship and probably feel that things had improved as a result.
Oh my God.
Well okay. I mean,
No. I'm guys, just keep going. I'm gonna need to get a live react from you guys on this though. Okay. Just keep going. But I got something for you.
Well, it's just again the scale that they're measuring this on was created by this guy who's just, I mean, he's so histrionic that in 2006 he was saying, you know, anybody who's right wing is self righteous and ill informed and dogmatic.
Right, you know, the definition of a right winger, like, you know, it's not your political ideology, it's how self-righteous and dogmatic you are, how ill-informed you are. The less you know, the better.
Yeah, and then it devolves into a whole bunch of stuff, how this relates to Trump and blah, 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 and it's all, you know, just vices, bullshit perspective. But it's just very heartening that it was taken as, by their measure, despite all the, you know, despite everything that they tried, there's a large proportion of Americans who are just like, no. And it's very clear that they see who these people are. They are white, and they are, you know, they're aging out. They're over 30. And that's why it's so important for them to continue this thing, process of, you know, driving down the white birth rate, you know, bringing more.
I need you guys to look at the Hangout right now. That's Bob Altermeyer.
Oh my God.
Are you looking at that
spectrum? Of course it is. Of course it is.
Oops. Oh. Looks like I got baby time again. Here. All right, continue, guys. I just wanted you to see Bob Altermeyer.
You can maximize the friction of your hand rubbing if you interlock your fingers.
You sure this isn't like one of those bankers from Harry Potter?
Yeah, right.
My mother was a Jew. My father was a goblin banker.
Sorry, I have dry mouth this morning. I'm in a different climate. So that's all I was going to say. It's, I don't know. I was making some point about, you know, they already are aware that the live birth rate for the current live birth rate, the majority is non-white, and the population of children under 18 is majority non-white. But they just got to keep the pressure on, because there's something at core in the call it the white identity, the European consciousness, or whatever, that will not betray reality. And that's the bigger picture. Maybe I'm going grand there, but I was kind of harkening back to it when I heard something somebody said. Borzo and I came up with that phrase, you know, all we're asking you to do is engage with reality. Because that feels like that's where all this, you know, the core of everything that we, you know, have come to believe and see in the narrative we have built comes from recognizing reality, not trying to lie to ourselves about, you know, and they have to keep the lies pouring on so hot and heavy all the time. And now, you know, any pushback, they just double down. And, you know, that's why it seems like people are starting to wake up.
Yeah, basically Bob Altermeyer is just stuff is just the, it's just a rehash of the, of the authoritarian personality stuff. That's actually, I'm seeing, like, here we go. You already covered a lot of this stuff, but yeah, it's got a Wikipedia page on this. I think because of how well aware people are of the Frankfurt School stuff and Adorno and all that nonsense. I mean, like, to the point that
Altmaier looks like Rumpel Foreskin.
There we go. There's the show title. Thank God. But you know, people are much more aware of Adorno and the authoritarian personality stuff. And a lot of that stuff's been discredited. I've brought this up before, but Christopher Lash, you know, who was he considered himself a neo-Marxist in terms of a lot of his thinking, although he was very defensive of, you know, the family as being kind of like a haven in a heartless world. But he did a review. He did a brief review of the authoritarian personality stuff, and basically, like, there's nothing scientific about this. In fact, the conclusions they're drawing don't really seem to make any sense with the data that they're working with. So, because of how discredited a lot of that stuff is, they're having to basically find a way to, like, well, how can we repackage this? How can we reboot this without having that Frankfurt School baggage? And that's what this right-wing authoritarian stuff, this RWA scale that Altmaier uses, that's where a lot of this comes from.
It is like the hot dog of science.
Took me a second.
I get it. I see what you did there. All right. Yeah, but that's all I had on that. I just thought it was just amusing. And I had something about... you don't have to pull it up, but the Boy Scouts reached a $850 million settlement with tens of thousands of sexual abuse victims. You know, oh, wow, I thought they told us 20 years ago that there was no problem letting openly gay scoutmasters and all that. But, you know, what you going to do? Just one more little token price on the road to destruction.
I hope you wrote that down, by the way. I'm juggling a child right now. Yeah.
I did.
Okay, good.
What about do you think he's settled enough for you to talk about anything you want to talk about, or
I can
hop around, or
I can hop around. I can easily. Oh, let's do four Jewish facts for the 4th of July. I'm kind of curious what this is. Now, this is from last year by Ann Cohen. This Saturday, American Jews will light candles for Havdalah and have fireworks for the 4th of July. Most American Jews trace their roots to immigration booms in the late 19th or early 20th century. But when the Declaration of Independence was signed on July 4th, 1776, there was already a significant Jewish presence in the nascent United States. Many were merchants or traders, and it's important to acknowledge that some owned or profited from trading enslaved people. Jews went on to fight on both sides of the Revolutionary War. Really? However you're marking the holiday this year, here are some Jewish intersections with Independence Day to keep in mind. Francis Salvador, 1747 to August 1st, 1776. The first Jew to die in the Revolutionary War was born into a prominent Ladino-speaking Sephardic family living in London. I can hear Stryker seething right now. As an adult, Salvador left his wife and children behind to immigrate to Charleston, South Carolina in 1773, hoping to make his fortune as a planter in the American colonies. In order to do so, he bought 30 enslaved people upon arriving in the colonies. It was their labor that allowed him to become one of the region's prominent figures and eventually to get involved in the American cause. Despite restrictions preventing Jews from holding office or voting, Salvador became the first Jew elected to the South Carolina General Assembly. He was killed by the British on August 1, 1776, during a skirmish on the South Carolina frontier border. What do you guys think about that fact? What do you think about that Jewish fact? Am I talking to myself right now? Did something happen? I guess I am talking to myself. What the? Okay, one second, guys. I kind of noticed it this morning. I didn't really pay any attention to it. I think Google Meet's got, like, this whole thing now. Where,
I noticed it too. It's where, like, Israelis are in control of it, and, like, you know, they could just kick us out at will.
Yeah, no, I think it's like basically like we want to save money on bandwidth or something, so we're limiting your Google Meets to like an hour or something.
That's gay.
Are we still live?
Yeah, we are. So I was just talking to myself for a while.
Well, actually, that relates to my favorite comment so far. Plot twist: the third rail has always been Borzoi talking to himself. The audience can hear the voices in his head too. Nice. Somehow we'll hear here.
Hey, buddy.
This is
thank you.
This is my headcanon.
All right. Well, we'll have to come.
Where were we?
I have a very well. I was reading Jewish facts about America of independence, but I have kind of a fussy child right now.
Okay, so, let me see what I got. Just off the top of my head. Okay. Actually, this is just off the top of my head. It was something I was when I was driving yesterday. I was listening to Fascination from Thursday, and they were talking about the Impossible Meat. And how they're going to try to, you know, undermine the laws to on packaging and labeling and, you know, do what they can to eventually get it to where, you know, just kind of sneak it in. And it's just over the course of a generation or so, just make it where there's no such thing as meat anymore. But I started thinking about the propaganda campaign that would accompany it. And it seems to me what they do, it would be very ham-fisted too, I'm sure. But over the course of a 5, 10, 20-year span, do to meat what they did to tobacco, what they rightly did to tobacco, to be honest. But, you know, when they start making it the focus of bad things, and the bad guys are always the ones who are eating meat, and then eventually go back and, you know, go back through the canon of things, you know, the content people watch still, Homer Simpson or whatever, eating bacon, and just that episode's no longer available, just like Bugs Bunny going after the Japs is no longer available. And you can see how this could play out pretty quickly and easily. To where, you know, meat eating becomes looked at even by, you know, Americans and Westerners as, you know, ew, it's repulsive.
That's going to be a hard one. I don't know.
I had to fill the time.
I feel like smoking is one thing that you can portray that way because, you know, the immediate association with tar, you know, ash, things that are, you know, repulsive just on a basic level, the same way like the idea of eating dirt is repulsive. But like when you're talking about an actual food product that is, it's universal, you know, that we have on an instinctual level, the desire to eat, you know, from our earliest existence as a species, you're fighting all of that time of evolution. And you think you can propagandize people out of it? I think that's it's a tall order for sure. Unlike smoking.
Come on, look how much they've altered society in 70 years. Come on.
All right, but like, if we're going to use smoking as the, you know, closest
comparison. I didn't mean smoking alone. That was just like the most recent media thing to where they actually go back into old movies and they will either digitally remove smoking or put like warnings on old movies like, warning contains violence, rape, and smoking. You know, they demonize them that way. And I didn't mean to limit it to just smoking as the way that they do it. I could just see them. I don't know. I feel like it's not going to be very long, if it already hasn't happened, before the people who are behind these, you know, impossible and alternative meat products are going to be hiring to gross out a PR people from PETA to try to put together a more sophisticated media product. That
yeah, if you're hiring those people, good luck.
No. I know. On the, left to their own devices, they're terrible. All their media campaigns are so tone deaf; it's ridiculous. But they do know how to get the worst of what, you know, like industrial farming or industrial ranching. They do know how to get to footage of the worst of the worst, the stuff that can gross you out. Now, couple that with the more media savvy, you know, Madison Avenue. The kind of ad firms that put and PR firms that put together the campaign against big tobacco back in the day, they could put together a more sophisticated media product to just make, you know, especially targeting younger people, because, you know, they know people will age out, so that over a generation, meat becomes looked upon as, you know, morally suspect and ooh, do you know what went into that in a way that it hasn't already done so. I mean, those little vegan messages and vegetarian messages get into some stuff, but that's not really high priority for them right now. But with the billions they're dumping into impossible meat and whatever plant part that plays in a larger plan, I feel like that's not too far afield for them to go and say, who is best at manipulating people with scenes of cruelty to animals or grossing people out about what's in their food?
Maybe they can do something
that's all I'm saying.
That impacts the aggregate demand. But, you know, just like smoking, which I feel is a valid point of comparison for discussing such things, you know, even with all of the laws that they've passed and the media, you know, manipulation put out on the subject, there's still millions of people who smoke.
Unfortunately.
I think when you're talking about eating meat, it's going to be like even larger. You might get some people, sure. But if you're not like outright making it illegal to produce, it's still going to be a popular food staple. And, you know, maybe it, even if it's not popular anymore, I will cynically conclude that only the right people will be eating it still.
Sure.
Like, if my enemies, you know, deny themselves the most potent source of protein that nature can produce, then fine. Fuck them. I don't want them to be eating it anyway. Cheaper for me. It'll be, you know, less people buying means lower prices for me.
I had to step away for a second, but McNabb's on now.
What's up,
guys? Oh, hey, Alex, how you doing, sir?
What's up? You guys are arguing about meat?
No. We were just talking about the media strategy that will accompany the slow replacement of real meat with all the meat alternatives.
I don't think that's going to happen.
I can just see it coming as all. I was filling time because Boar's always baby got fussy.
Well, this you guys might be want to get ready to just do a show without me a little bit. my wife has to sleep, and I have Borsling. So, although he's being chill for the moment.
Here we go. Bottle time.
I know this feel. Hey, thanks for the grill. The grill that you guys sent. Shane loved it.
McNabb just grill. The grill.
Oh yeah.
I like that print. That print that you guys sent from Andy was fucking awesome. I've got it hanging upstairs on my wall.
We got so for people who don't know, which is basically everybody, my wife and I got a plastic grill for McNabb's kids to play with.
Nice.
Yeah. Just want very a grill, damn it.
Yeah, very tiny. Like,
grill some meat.
Spectre, like imagine that, you know, you have to, you know, fully remove the toy grills from the market to as part of this propaganda campaign. I mean, it's doable, but like that's such a uphill battle to fight. I don't think they could ever really like claim total victory without like, you know, hard power like enforcing total legal meat bans.
Well, yeah, they haven't banned cigarettes either. People still smoke.
Yeah.
Tobacco products still exist. And I don't know. Smoking is a little bit different. I mean, that was an artificial thing in the first place, right? Like we didn't historically smoke cigarettes until
That was my first point. Like you're fighting literally a whole species timeline of evolution of like, yes, we eat meat,
right?
At the most basic level, we will like start marathon running to exhaust meat so we can eat it.
Yeah, but the other thing too is smoking is actually, it is nasty, and when people finally realized what it was like to go to a bar where there was no smoking, suddenly everyone was like, oh, maybe we should just not do this anymore. Like this is actually gross. I remember those days.
Yeah, I was not ever saying that they could eliminate it, because there'll be that constant push back and forth the same way there is to this day between tobacco and anti-tobacco and all that. My point was just you can foresee the media campaign to come, how they're going to do it in television and movies, and they're going to retcon old, you know, popular content, and just, you know, do everything to make it to where it's the bad guys who are always eating meat. You know, they shoot the scene where they're plotting the terrorist attack, and they'll do it while carving a turkey or some bullshit. I'm just saying, I'm not saying that it will be 100% effective. I'm saying you can see what the media campaign will be. And how ham-fisted it'll probably be, pun intended.
Yeah, I think I don't know. My hope is that because I will concede I don't put that beyond them. That is definitely the level of petty that they're willing to go. But I think at a certain point, it's just going to get tacky. It's going to get lame, and everybody's going to know it. They're going to be like, seriously. Again with the meat, the villain meat thing. I don't know. I feel like they are going to try that, but it's going to go out of style.
Look at it now, though. But right now, the villain is always the white guy. So no one's, except for us, is saying we're kind of sick of this.
All right, but you know, are you really going to have a movie where you know, a bunch of criminal Negroes are just feasting on fried chicken. I mean, you should, but are they? Will they make that movie?
Good point.
They want us to not eat meat, right?
Hmm. You have the fried chicken dilemma once again befalls us.
Yes. But if we want to use this as a transition into my topic, because I think we've had this back and forth to death now.
Yeah, but did you mention the Spic Negro cycle?
No.
You're familiar with this, right?
Oh yes, but I'm not. I don't see exactly how this it fits into the.
They would have to shut it down. Dude, I'm
sure. Oh, right, because the whole cycle is feeding them fried meats. You're right. That's the core tenet of it.
This is what all Western technology and scientific innovation is about. It's about figuring out how to stuff Negroes full of fried chicken meat.
I don't think our economy can handle it. Yeah, now I'm totally convinced, Spectre. It's not even they're not even gonna try it because our economy cannot handle it. We require certain levels of meat consumption. That we just can't afford to lose.
If you think about it, when you see a fat, obese Negro, that's just corporate profit right there. Those are dollars. Those are dollars hanging off of that Negro.
Are you actually saying it would be hard to pull bait and switch on?
I think so.
I don't know. Actually. It seems like it would be hard to
bait and switch. I think the answer to that question is yes.
The McNuggets.
What are you gonna? Oh, like trying to replace that, you know, the fried chicken shaped hole with Impossible Chicken. I don't know. Perhaps maybe that's how we survive. You know, our economy survives the transition as the replacement with Impossible Chicken. Maybe they just don't tell them. Maybe they just start doing it. Like they set they like. There's a, it's like the second Patriot Act.
That's what I'm saying.
Instead of like being like a
well, no, they're gonna prism erode laws to where
there's like going to be some like a pork barrel bill, and like buried deep within it is like some change of FDA regulations that you no longer are required to properly label foods when you sell them. So they can just start selling you the fake fried chicken and the blacks will keep buying it.
That's what I'm getting at. They'll also do that. They're going to we actually have some decent food labeling laws in this country. They're going to first undermine those. Or that's not what the first they're going to do because that's going to take a longer term strategy. The first thing they're going to do is go in with the marketing language and they're going to come in the advertising language. Like they were mentioning on FTN that like right now what they're calling it is cultured meats, and you could easily see them just like you know slipping in like phrases or you know that neurolinguistic programming to where it's like you're already used to the expression cured meats, right? So we have an array of cultured and cured meats, yeah. And it just sounds like oh, that sounds normal, that sounds healthy, that sounds natural.
Well, that stuff's different from the soy. The cultured meat is like the bio lab engineered, technically,
right, right.
The chemical makeup is the same thing as meat, but it didn't come from a living animal.
Right, right. That's what I'm getting at. When they're going to start, when they start, you know, that's what all the impossible meat and all that stuff is. So while they're trying to get the laws on labeling change, they're also going to get really smart with the packaging and the labeling, and they're going to get real clever with, you know, trick words that will obey the law, the letter of the law, but will easily fool the average consumer into thinking they're buying real meat. That's all I'm getting at.
That's a good
I didn't even want to, this was just a random thought while I was driving yesterday.
Well, this is I'm not able to hear most of what you guys are talking about because I basically have a mini crisis in my hands right here. But this also seems like a good point to talk about. Alex had sent me a link about birth rates, and I know that's kind of been Alex's hobby horse for a while. I didn't really get a chance to read that. What do you got going on with that, Alex?
Oh, no. This goes into a completely different thing. This all got started because someone with an anime profile picture was talking about marriage. And anytime you have somebody with an anime profile picture talking about marriage, you're going to hear some good stuff. So what they were suggesting, is that feminists had raised the average that women get married so that they would not have to compete with 14-year-old girls. This would enable like older women to not have to do that. And my
very
mind
anime profile picture opinion.
Yeah, well, my mind was blown. I'd never heard that particular argument before. I was like, you've hit like a new height here of spurgery. Like that's a new one. And it's completely ahistorical. So I was digging around, pulling up information on our what's called the Western European marriage pattern, which generally white people in Europe historically have married later. Like 18 to 25 is generally when they start getting married. There were periods in England where the average age that a man got married was 28. The average age for a woman was 26. So this has been a pattern for a very, very long time. In fact, there were laws in England back 200 years ago that you couldn't get married unless you were 21. That was before feminism ever existed. So this entire idea that you had people raising the age of marriage to avoid competition with 14-year-olds is just, you know, insane. But yeah, so I had pulled up another study that I've been looking for because I'd stumbled on it a couple years ago and couldn't find it. But I found it again, and this one was interesting, talking about the pattern in French populations in Canada and in France from, I think, 1600 to 1700. The average age that women got married was 23, and they had children until they were 39 to 41 years old, which seems to puncture a lot of assumptions people have about reproductive patterns. Like, that's kind of an old age, you would think, to be having children. They would consider that a geriatric pregnancy in modern terms.
Well, that's like your last pregnancy,
right,
to be fair.
Last one, yeah.
So the majority of your pregnancies are going to happen before then. I don't know. Did it include like the average number of kids?
I think it was, they were generally having about four or five.
Four? So that's several years spacing between them. Assuming you start, your first one is early on into your marriage. By the time, if you're having your fourth, by the time you're 40, I mean, you could be spacing them out years apart.
That's a good spacing. I wish I could do that.
You're not very good at it.
No, I suck at this. Because ideally, you should get about 2 years or so. And no, that didn't work out the way for me.
Better luck next time.
Yeah, right. And actually, I think the reason there's this perception that women above the age of like 30 are not going to be able to have children, I think this is due to boomers. I think that what happened is the CDC and medical organizations, they started doing research in the 70s, and they were looking at boomers. And as we all know, what boomers did is they popped out a couple kids and then they got their tubes tied. So that skewed their number, their data set.
Do you think unhealthy pregnancies at an older age, has that changed over time, like in terms of diet and like chemical exposures that people face in our lives nowadays versus, you know?
Well, one thing I wonder, it's like we've got all this medical science. It's probably enabling people to survive and reproduce that shouldn't. So, yeah, sure, you've probably got a lot of unhealthy people in their late 30s that are somehow getting pregnant and getting that baby out, and the baby surviving despite the fact that both of them probably should have died of scarlet fever when they were two.
That's a good point.
Yeah. No, I definitely agree that it's like you've got lower quality individuals reproducing for sure.
I come back to this conversation being summarized as retard maxing. Which, dude, that could be a show. I think that might be the show title.
It's 2021. You're not tard maxing your kids. Not going to make it.
Well, I mean, I make this joke on Tedious all the time, but I'm stealing this from Dutton to an extent, but like, you've got a lot of the population today that they should have died of scarlet fever. Like, they should have been killed by an early childhood disease. They should not be out walking around with the rest of us with their broken brains and their broken bodies. They ought not to be around. Like, if you ever go wander around a graveyard, if you, even not that long ago, like in the 1960s, you'll see a lot of graves for babies, for kids under the age of five. You'll see a lot of those. And that changed. Like, infant mortality dropped, so you have a lot of people that were supposed to be weeded out, but here they are.
And it's never a nice thing to talk about, but that's just the reality. That's the way nature works.
Yeah, well, the way I look at it is you pop out all these duds. It's like, oh, there's another dud. Gotta try again. The duds are supposed to be pruned. They're not supposed to be surviving.
Yeah. For some reason, I think it was because I was like, when I was driving and I was like switching between podcasts and the radio came on and it was like a Bono song or some shit like that. And I don't know why, it's just my mind was just drifting at that point from the hours I'd been driving. And I started thinking about, I was alive back during the 80s, during the whole UN Live and all that crap.
Like the Civil
War. And then
War.
Bono getting into Africa. Yeah. No, 1980s, nigger. but no, and what, whether I don't want to lie and look, and I don't actually want to bother doing the research, but you know, there was like what, 1/10 of the African population in the 1980s as there is today. And it's all because of the, let's go feed them, let's go save them, let's go inoculate them, let's go make sure that, you know, these huge litters they have, as many as of them, despite what nature is trying to do.
Are you talking about Africans in Africa, or are you talking about in the United States? Because I know it was, I can't remember his name, was like Norman Green something. Like the guy behind the Green Revolution, I mean, he's credited because there was supposed to basically be a mass starvation that happened in the 20th century just based off of, you know, just based off of what the projections were for, and there was one guy who was able to, Norman Borlaug. He basically revolutionized how they could the agriculture for the 20th century and prevented a mass starvation event in the 20th century.
No. I was just literally talking about how the big, you know, the big sob story, USA for Africa, Live Aid, Feed the World stuff started really in the 1980s with the whole pop music stuff, and that became a cause, and then. Just what, 30 years later, the African population is 10 times what it was, and they're flooding into Europe.
Well, that stuff came
out. I don't mean to sound ghoulish when it comes to. I do want to clarify here because this took a turn for the serious beyond what we normally do. But when I talk about, when we talk about something like a famine and or nature taking its course, that's a whole different thing, you know, letting it happen versus making it happen. You know, the Holodomor versus, look, if they have to learn how to sustain themselves, and if we go in there and just throw rice at them, they're just going to be overrun and still not know how to feed themselves.
Ironic. They've had the highest period of population growth in Africa at the same time as, you know, the start of AIDS. Like AIDS actually correlates to the highest rate of population growth in African history.
Well, I'm not making any editorial comments on any of this. I'm just, the simple facts are is that we have the African population we do because of Norman Borlaug's Green Revolution, and the Live Aid stuff piggybacked off of that because the population exploded, and despite the advances in agricultural development, there were still so many people they had to feed, so
without Borlaug, you wouldn't be able to have, you know, the surplus food for Live Aid, you know, charity events.
I don't think the prime directive is ghoulish. If you're just like, if this is a primitive society, we should not interfere.
No, and that's what I was trying to get across. Is I 100% agree with that.
Yeah, we're not good at tinkering with the supply and demand of you know, the dark continent.
Any given ecosystem.
I mean, we're pretty good at managing livestock when they're in a pen, but like a whole uncontrollable continent of Africans, not so much.
It's actually kind of a weird thing to do. It's like, well, the gazelle are starving, so we need to airlift a bunch of hay over there. Get hay and grain to these gazelles. Shit.
Did it happen again? Oh, no. Oh, wait. What the heck?
Your recording second one, I think, dropped out.
Okay. That's weird. Well, just keep going. Okay, I guess I'm still here.
Yeah, you're still on. Don't worry. So I don't know how this impossible meat thing became a feeding Africa, but I was just falling.
Well,
down the time.
I mean, because everything is impossible.
Because we're gonna. Feed
I do know one of the things related to this. It was another road thought yesterday, which was As they were explaining how these cultured meats, not like the vegan, the bean burgers that we've seen before, but the actual, you know, the stuff that goes into making these artificial chicken and artificial beef patties and all that, you know, once they develop it, it becomes like the same thing that is reproduced over and over and over. And occurred to me that, like, you know, let's say that they win the culture war, beef is done away with, everybody eats this meat from now on, they get their way, yada yada yada. So 25 generations from now, what's going to be the effect on the population of eating this static, never changing protein source? You know, as opposed to the way, you know, the ebb and flow of, you know, different proteins, you know, famines, periodicity, whatever, through time has done to human development. It seems like one of those things, like, there are natural solutions to unnatural problems that are presented, like incest. It is repulsive to us because we know that it produces these unnatural outcomes. Or, and Alex, maybe you can help me here, I think there's some specific disease that people get from eating human brains. Or from cannibalism.
Yes, there is.
So it's like nature almost like fights back when humans try to do something unnatural.
It's not even like a disease. It's like a malformed protein or something.
That just utterly destroys your brain tissue.
Yeah. Yeah. Prion diseases are very strange, very unique.
So I'm just wondering what's going to happen with a meat source that's, let's say they develop the perfected version of it in 2025. And then in 2525, how's that going to have affected the, you know,
human development? Did you ever play a game called Half-Life 2?
I'm aware of it, but I never played it.
In the game, there is this thing called the Combine Advisor. The Advisor is like the evil overlords, and the Advisors are these big, fat, pale slug things, and they live in pods, and they're completely dependent on technology. That's where we're going.
Mm.
You won't need arms and legs where we're going.
So let's say the people behind the grand brains behind the Impossible Meat stuff heard my objection, and they said, no, don't worry. With every generation, with every decade, with every year, if we really need to, if we see problems developing in the population because of the consumption of this static meat product, we can adjust it so that it's better for them. It's like, oh, that's very comforting to me to know that the source of my actual existence, those who supply my food, can now control the outcome of its effect on me. That's very reassuring.
That's not.
I mean, we're totally a paranormies territory here, but
what they do is they adjust your expectations. So you're like, I don't want to be 500 pounds. Well, you should learn to love being 500 pounds. That's not a problem. Yeah.
You're healthy at any size. You're healthy at any limb count.
Your legs may have fallen off, but now we can sell you this mobility chair.
Healthy in any pod.
Yeah. You know, the thing is, a lot of people will be happy for the pod. They're already there. They're already there. They sit in front of their TV and they eat massive, copious amounts of food every single day. For a lot of them, they're going to willingly walk into the pod.
And a lot of people who say that they will never go into the pod, I would like to actually challenge them to, okay, let's say you have a nice apartment, a nice size house. I want you to actually think about how much area you actually occupy on any given day.
See?
Or on a day that you are actually home all day. And then you realize that area that you actually occupy is probably pretty small. It might fit in a pod.
See? Spectres make a good argument. Get excited for pod.
Yes, 1 billion Americans.
In pods.
This is
if you're in a pod, you can cram them all together.
This is the fat Iglesias future.
And the best thing, pods are mobile. You know, you get laid off from XYZ Corporation and you get hired. The only other job you can get is, you know, 7,000 miles away. Well, who needs family and friends? Just climb into your pod and then they'll relocate you.
Yeah, now this is pod racing. I myself am a pod racist.
The Amazon drone will pick up your pod, take you to your next job.
Yeah, no, the biggest competition will be like, Uber and Lyft will be antiquated. Now it'll be Amazon or Tesla to who picks up your pod. You know, which drone sharing service do you use to transport your pod?
I'm actually having a nightmare vision of the future, and I'm halfway serious here, where, you know, the Amazon policy of, like, you never work the same shift with anybody that you've seen before. Mm-hmm. So they've got you living in a pod. Maybe it's an even, you know, a nice pod, 20 or say what, 10 by 10, 15 by 10, whatever.
It's a Gucci
it's
pod.
It's enough to make you comfortable. It's a nice enough pod. And you got all your Goy feed. You got your little hamster Goy feeder there feeding you. You got your Xbox. You're all set to go. Basically, Amazon ships your pod every day to where they need you to work that next shift to neighbors anymore for more than one shift. You get to sleep while your pod's being moved so that you can literally never develop a single human interaction.
Wow.
That's the future.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, and it's beautiful. That's the future. That's
Everybody beautiful. Should want this.
And you'll never see another human in person. You know, now we've got the coronavirus thing in place to
think about. You know, no more pandemics.
No. Yeah, they've got a good excuse. All they got to do is ramp it up with the next pandemic. Then you got everybody living in your pods. Your pods being transported by drones every day to a different place. You know, if you ever interact with people, it's holograms. They can reshape your perception of the world, and I mean, they will literally at that point control your perception of the world, who populates it, everything. Because there will be no access to each other or to like original source material or anything. You won't ever spend a day in the same place.
Actually, the rest of the world and society around you is essentially going to be depopulated. Everybody will be in the pod.
Yeah,
it's just going to be. This
is the end of the McNabb equation of why travel is gay.
Yeah, from
barren landscapes with pods flying back and forth.
It starts with cagers and ends with potters.
I have a whole thing on that. See, what the American consumer really wants is they want to be in their own personal tram car. They don't want cars anymore. They don't want to drive. Driving is a chore to people. People don't want to be having to engage their personal autonomy. They want something to take them to a place. They don't want a train because then they have to interact with other humans. What they want is a personal tram car. And that's where the technology is going. Self-driving cars, driver assists, all that stuff. That's the direction that the automotive industry is evolving towards.
And don't even have to pay a driver, a chauffeur.
Yeah. You want to be in the pod, ultimately.
The pod singularity.
I don't know. I wanna reject modernity, return to Monkey and like get a rickshaw. Yeah. Have McNabb like drag me around on a rickshaw.
Well, the only alternative service you can offer in this new world is your rickshaw will carry the pod. You will be pulling pods around.
Well, that's a gig economy job right there.
You'll also be one of the only humans left with legs. So there's that.
Yes. Too. You know, if you're a limb privileged person, then you can still carry people around in their pod rickshaw, their pod show. No, it's more like a pod barrow.
Oh, what the fuck?
Hey guys, so this is gonna be a little bit weird, but I really need to take him for a walk because he's very not happy, and this thing's gonna time out. So I'm gonna set up another Google Hangout right now, and I'm gonna because this thing's gonna time out in about 25 minutes. And then you guys can continue the show without me.
So what do we do?
I'm gonna email you guys another Google Hangout and just continue it without me. I'm gonna take my son for a walk.
You're gonna put him in a pod.
Yes, exactly.
Pod walk.
I mean, when you think about it, the stroller is the proto pod rickshaw. I mean, it's deeper embedded in our culture and in our ways than we think.
But the stroller literally has the cart before the horse.
It doesn't have to be.
I guess not.
I can design you a pull baby carriage tomorrow.
So I think they're going to get you to eat the impossible meat by when you're in the pod. There'll be virtual reality, right? So it'll look like steak to you. And they will even maybe
just like Blade Runner 2049.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just like in the Matrix. Like you're going to think that you're eating chicken, but eventually you won't even know what chicken tastes like. have no reference. Chicken will just be a form of branding for product.
Yeah, when you think about it, I mean, like I said, like if they could literally determine, you know, if they could change the program of the cultured meat, the formula or whatever, you know, just gradually over time, over 10 years, you know, 20 years, all of a sudden, meat, no, the chicken, they chicken, whatever they want it. It's like whatever gruel they want to serve you next. So that now you're used to that gruel or bugs or whatever.
Which came first, the chicken or the egg? Well, whatever they served me that day.
I'm not sure I get that one.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's the thing is to be like, I don't like this chicken. Give me the beef flavor. But they'll both taste like gruel. They'll both taste like some sort of reconstituted artificial protein. But you just won't know.
It's like, you know, that'll be the future Coke or Pepsi, beef or chicken.
So what were you guys talking about?
Well, Spectre was getting into some show feature meta.
What?
Pod racing. We were talking about pod racing.
Before that we were doing pod racing, but Spectre starts to discuss some show prep meta. Did you have anywhere you were going to go with that or no?
Yeah. So I decided to watch a movie and discuss it with Borzoi.
What movie?
That would be a new and exciting kind of a thing.
It could be an interesting bit.
It actually was actually an interesting movie. It was because I was like thumbing through Red Letter Media, and it was one of their compilation, like, you know, catch ups or whatever from Penn or whatever. And it's from 2020, a movie called Pretty Young Woman. And there's so much in it that it's just very bias confirming all the way through, while at the same time it's trying so hard to be this. It's trying to be clever, and there are some clever moments, and it's pretty well shot. But they're so ham-fisted with the messaging that it does the horseshoe thing, where in trying to prove their point about how toxic masculinity is or whatever, they actually prove that the masculine outlook is the proper one. You know, where the only time she ever comes out on top is when she adopts masculine instead of feminine tactics and that sort of thing. But it was also just kind of interesting because it's done, like the tone of it, it starts where you're not really sure if she's doing something really awful. And then you find out, and by the middle of it, why she's doing what she's doing, and then it gets really dark. And they were trying to go for sort of a, you know, what was that movie from the Heathers from 1989, I think. Maybe it's from 87. Anyway, that's not the point. And at the same time, it had this sort of a 90s rom-com feel to it, complete with like a dancing montage in the middle of it. While at the same time, she's doing, you know, it's mostly suggested off screen, but she's doing some really awful things as revenge. And also there's a rape scene that's also mercifully off screen that gives us this very dark edge. And so it kind of balances it, but at the same time, you're kind of left disquieted by the tone of it. But it's just really funny because it's, as I was watching, I was like, this feels like a movie directed by a feminist who has no idea how men actually think or how men actually are. And it was feels like it was directed by a woman who has no idea how men are and how we actually think and what we actually say. Turns out it's the same woman, writer, director. I don't know. And surprisingly, when I looked at like who was on the production list, and unless Margot Robbie is Jewish, it looks like a very goyish production crew. So I don't know. Let's see now. I'm not going to go through scene by scene or anything like that, but it was. Do you remember Corey Mulligan from the movie Drive?
Vaguely.
Which character was that?
The girlfriend in the movie Drive.
Oh, yeah.
You know, kind of cute, quirky.
The Castiza.
Yeah, in real life, she's 35. She's playing a character that's 30, But I don't know if it was the lighting. I don't know if it was the way she was shot or if this girl has just been rode hard and put away wet. But she looked like, have you ever seen like one of those Florida women who were like 55 and they are wearing obviously a blonde wig and they dress like their daughter and they're like, everybody thinks my daughter and me are sisters.
Oh, God.
You know, yes. What I'm talking about?
I've seen that like on the internet and it's just pain. Like the there's like a level of mental illness behind that kind of personality.
Yeah, and what she does is she goes around to bars and acts like she's like falling down drunk. Gets guys to lure her back to their place, and then depending on there's a cheap hotel and or a thin walls hotel and there's fire trucks went by. I don't know if y'all heard that. It turns out she does either some very nasty things to them or just simply shames them depending on their level of offense to her sensibilities. But she's also on a revenge kick because her girlfriend in med school, something happened to her at some kind of a frat party. And there's a video of it that resurfaces. And this is right after she had kind of had an epiphany that her little revenge binge was, you know, she needed to go ahead and end it because she had found this boyfriend and she had seen this guy who was begging for forgiveness for being a lawyer for guys who had been accused of date rape. And then she sees the video and of course her boyfriend's among one of the guys at the frat party. World, there's like 50 people out there, right? But it's just, The point of of watching it, aside from just I was bored, and Red Letter Media had recommended it, was as I was watching it, just like I said, it came across as this messaging, like it really, really wanted to come across as this kind of pro-feminist, all males are rapists. Literally every male in this movie is, to one degree or another, a rapist. And every woman who doesn't basically stand right behind the woman crying rape is an enabler. I mean, either physically or mentally tortures to some degree or another the college professor who gave the accused boy innocence, the assumption of innocence before guilt, a rapist, a date rapist, a drunk guy making just advances, a friend who saw it, a man on the street, a nice guy, a man who was so repentant he was begging her to kill him. All are, you know, still equally guilty in this movie's eyes. And it's just kind of funny because the only resolution she ever comes to, it does have a very dark and weird ending, and it's actually makes it pretty interesting. But the big irony of it is, and I'm sorry if I'm taking too long with this, is I just didn't know how much longer Borzoi would be out of pocket. The only time she ever does anything successful is by acting like a man. And not being, you know, the only way women can be successful is acting like men is kind of like the unintentional message of this movie. Anyway, I just want to throw that out there. I also watched that, but I also watched Alongside Night that they had just mentioned in the review. And oh my God, that was the absolute worst movie I've ever seen in my life. Yeah, I cringed all the way through it.
I want to watch that.
You really do? It's so horrible.
What's it about? Horrible.
It's a libertarian.
He just dropped out. He just dropped out.
It's that bad. It dropped him out.
Yeah, he was about to describe it, and then Google said no.
Yeah, it's about agorism. We talked about this on Tedious. It's like, Neil Shulman? Neil Shulman wrote this book alongside Night, and there's some kind of film adaptation. I kind of want to like have a few drinks and watch it. I just slog my way through it.
Is it supposed to be like an action movie or a?
I'm not sure what the. I know that it involves the concepts of agorism.
I feel like the way you could make agorism interesting in a story is like, you know, make it like a thriller, like an action thriller.
Or just have pod racing.
Have pod racing. Makes any movie fun for the whole family.
I actually dropped out there for a second, but the movie was interestingly not just an adaptation of J. Neil Shulman's Alongside Night novel, but he directed it and he had a cameo in it as well. So it's that bad. I mean, the levels of badness on this have made me where I was when you asked me what the book was about or the movie was about. I'm still trying to remember. I can't quite recall.
So what is the genre of it?
Well, it's near future dystopian American collapse. You have the state. It's the standard libertarian fantasy novel, basically. Kind of Atlas Shrugged, kind of. I think, yeah, Atlas Shrugged probably the best comparison, where, you know, the economy is kind of on the verge of collapse. There's a secret cadre of good-hearted anarchists. There's the, in the middle, libertarians, and then there's the evil statists. And the movie, which seemed to have been lit by a flashlight, if I had to hazard a guess, and perhaps shot on someone's, like, you know, the camera on an iPhone or an iWatch, you know what I'm saying? Like, that kind of resolution. It centers around the son of a famous Nobel economist, a modern day Friedrich Mises, F.A. Hayek, kind of all rolled into one, played by Hercules, the Legendary Journeys. What's his name? Anybody? Hercules, the Legendary Journeys, the TV series?
Yeah. Yeah, it's got Kevin Sorbo and then Sam Sorbo's in it.
Sorbo, that's it. Yeah, he's played by Sorbo.
Yeah.
That's it. So Kevin Sorbo is this economist, and it centers around his 16-year-old son, who dresses like one of the Columbine killers, even though this movie was made in 2014. He's like always walking around in a trench coat. Who, you know, he knows how to use guns. He knows how to use computers. He has sex with a prostitute. It's presented as a good thing. It's just libertarian anarcho-capitalist paradise bullshit.
Hey, that's and a great idea for a post-apocalyptic piece of screenwriting. So you've got the character who he's training himself to be a school shooter. And then the apocalypse happens, and he's got all these skills and weapons. Yeah, that's actually cool. I like that idea.
That's actually a good story.
It's like, who do I shoot when there's no more school?
Damn, that would actually be a good movie or a good short story.
Like that, like that's actually an excellent story arc too, because it starts out like you're just a psycho. You're like a total like embodiment of senseless evil. And then you actually like find some purpose in life now that the world has gone to hell, and you know you just have a desire to kill.
Right, you have to rebuild society so you can be oppressed by it and then melt down and kill a bunch of people.
Yeah, how would that be for an ironic ending? It would be very unsatisfying to the viewer if you if like the end is just all right. Now I can have my school shooting.
Oh well, this movie, like I said, it's not only the Jewish libertarian novelist. He also directed it, and he had a little cameo in it. And he also has cameos from, you know, name a living libertarian sci-fi writer, and they're probably in this movie at some point, giving the worst stilted, you know, pop movie references. It's so bad. It is so bad. Something like. The father fakes his own death, so, and then tries to reunite his family because the government wants. And at first, they think the anarchists are the bad guys, but then it turns out they're the good guys. And Mr. Tuvok and Ensign Harry Kim are with the anarchists. And something happens, and the families are reunited again, and people have. Average people on the street have very, very spurty, heated arguments about monetary policy throughout this whole movie.
Damn, it's like a
teenage girls have
a throwback to the days of a silver versus gold standard when people would actually talk about this in normal life.
The teenage girls have posters of libertarian philosophers and writers on their walls, the same way they would like Tiger Beat or. You know, whatever boy band is, you know, you get the idea. It's presented just
such LARP.
That sounds like the most amazing meme material. Like, there's got to be so many drops in this movie.
Oh my god, so it's wonderful. And then I think about a third of the movie is taken up by product placement. of like
really
his novels, his friend's novels, like where they're talking about, you need to read this.
But
you need to read this to get the lowdown on why the government wants the gold. And then the movie's name is Alongside Night for the chat. Sorry. J. Neil Schulman. And then what was the icing on the cake? At some point, because in all these kind of stories, every libertarian anarcho-capitalist has a Galt's Gulch to retreat to.
Uh-huh.
And this whole movie was, by the way, shot in Vegas because that's like libertarian capital, right? Supposedly, in this increasingly statist land, the anarchists have built an underground hotel and shopping center. And it seems like a third of the movie was taken up with the main character, the son, who is, you know, just a standard libertarian, still believes there needs to be some laws, being taken around in front of a green screen, of course. And making the libertarian versus statist arguments about, well, what do you mean you don't have any restrictions on selling me these drugs? What do you mean you have no laws, you have no problem if I give these drugs away to children? What do you mean I can't buy a nuclear weapon? You know, it's like this is in you. The takeaway from this, my friends, is in the standard mind of a functioning libertarian, that's how they perceive the world. That all around them, people are in individual transactions. And when they're not in individual transactions, they're in spurgy fucking arguments about the non-aggression principle and who can sell what to whom. And this movie, it's so beautiful. It's the indictment of, I mean, it's...
I definitely recommend it. Sucked in with that kind of interpersonal drama, arguing about monetary policy, that's a good way to write a script.
Oh, and then I guess I that's all I have to say about it. Other than I think there's some kind of among libertarian writers, because I was guilty of being one at one point, and I've read a lot of them. They all are. There's some little tendency. They all have to be too clever for their own good with their characters, and their characters are always too clever for their own good. And I just wonder. That seems to be a. I don't know. There's something there to be analyzed.
Yeah, because you get in trouble as a libertarian for being so smart. You realize the flaws with the monetary policy and the fact that we need to go back to a gold standard, and that gets you in trouble with the state.
It's like you know mm-hmm. the forbidden you know knowledge.
Much. Yeah.
Yeah, you know too much.
Yeah, so that's all I had on that. It was just I watched a couple of movies while I was doing some downtime from book editing. And I just wanted to shock or just kind of annoy Borzoi with the idea of, hey, I've got a new bit for us. Let's talk about a movie.
So you basically what you want to do is just like watch films and just live stream that? We kind of almost did that
one, right? Live react.
Yeah.
Well, the Riff Racks people figured out how to do that and monetize it without getting in trouble.
Really?
Well,
I guess for the movies that they have like public, talking.
They either I guess they're, no, there's two ways to do it. You can either, you know, obviously the public domain movies you can have access to. Probably the lower rent B movies from the 50s that they do, they probably don't have to pay a whole lot in royalties, you know, to get more permissions to use it. But then the third option is you just put out an audio track that's synced to the movie of you guys, you know, talking about it as it's playing.
I did that a long then, time ago. That was like
people put the movie on. It's like 1, 2, 3 sync, and then there's no copyright issues.
I did that a long time ago on a podcast called Sedition Cast. Throwback to the early days. For that, do you remember that documentary, Growing Up Trans?
I've never seen that.
Oh, it was so bad.
Is that the Jazz Jenny one?
No, this was, I think this was before Jennings was, in the media sphere.
Well, see, Jennings is also trying to complete transformation into a big, fat, slug pod creature with no appendages.
Jazz Jennings will be the first slug potter, the slug potter.
Hey, it's the middle of recording and live streaming, and my laptop wants to update. Do you want to install the updates now?
Yeah, this is a good time.
Couldn't you be more helpful? I've got 5 apps actively running why wouldn't I want to install it now?
Yeah, no, I was doing intervals on Zwift the other day, and Windows is like, do you want to do an update? I'm like, no, fuck no, you just closed my fucking window. What are you doing? I thought it was smart enough to figure out that the user was busy doing something and to put the update, like, I don't know, during the evening when you're asleep, when you're in your pod.
Hey, Spectre, are you able to play a video and have it cast over the call?
You mean like now?
Yeah.
Boar's always able to do that, but if he's just being silent, he could probably.
That sucks.
Oh no, he's listening, but he's walking the baby. That's right, because he says he's thinking about walking back inside and killing us. Oh no, killing the stream. I'm so used to the violent threats from him. I can't see if I don't know if I had anything else like actual. I saw, but I already closed the window. The Kamala Harris's office. It's like fucking falling apart. Which, you know, what do you expect?
Yeah, collapse.
Bear with me. I mean, it's falling apart faster than it is really something something. Can you hear me still?
Yeah.
Just
took him there. Again, so I'm still on that shitty hotel Wi-Fi. It seems like it's going slow sometimes. The White House dove into damage control this week after reports of dysfunction in the fighting, and Vice President Kamala, who gives a fuck, Harris's office, with the administration trying to stop a drama-filled narrative from taking hold, according to five people who spoke to CNN about the dynamics within Harris's office. Two people close to Harris's team said that some individuals inside the VP's office are frustrated with what they see as a dysfunctional operation that has at times been waylaid by internal conflict. Great, great editing there, CNN. Some of that ire is directed squarely at Harris's chief of staff, Tina Flournoy. Those people said. Another source close to the staff said there were challenges and struggles and heard complaints about Flournoy from staff, but denied it amounted to dysfunction or that the tensions were directly Flournoy's fault. Oh my God.
Perfect. This is actually the best news. My opinion is I want specifically Kamala Harris's office to be the most dysfunctional and non-starter in the whole administration. I want her to be able to accomplish nothing.
Oh yeah, I see that. Article. It's Politico saying her office is rife with dissent.
Uh-huh.
Perfect.
Yeah.
More of this, please.
You put two women in a room, they're going to argue. Now imagine putting a power-hungry, frizzy-haired mulatto, troubled mulatto, in a position of power where she's inches away from actual power, or at least perceived actual power. Yeah. But she's still just basically a ribbon cutter. And of course, we know Joe's not going to be—he's not going to finish his term. There's no fucking way they can keep him propped up that long. So she knows she's just waiting in the wings, and so you can imagine how just angry these people are, and how much they—you know—it's like her staff, you know, these black women demanding better parking places from the Secret Service. No,
they're fighting over parking spaces, guaranteed. They are fighting over parking spaces.
Oh God, yeah, and whether they can have a strawberry daiquiri machine in the break room.
That's not an exaggeration. I saw two women fight it out. It was a hospital administrator and a local EMS supervisor got into a months-long battle over fucking parking spaces, because that's how petty women are. Women are petty as shit, and they are very bad at cooperating. That's the other thing. There's a lot of lies that are told about human civilization, but the biggest one is like, oh, women get along and women are cooperative. No, they are not.
Yeah,
they are primitive, bloodthirsty savages.
The adage even that if women ran the world, there would be no more wars. It's like, yeah, okay. Like bombing parking spots.
Even if I could find it, I couldn't put it up.
You can do things like appeal to a man's self-interest, and he will like cooperate with other males, even if he doesn't want to.
And even
do that with
women. Well, even when women try to cooperate, they don't quite do it right. And like I was about to say, even if I could find it, I couldn't put it up right now. But there's this great video of this woman's trying to parallel park. And there's, you know, two cars. There's one space that, you know, a man could easily park in. But she's kind of in and out, in and out, and out. She can't get it right. And finally, this woman walks him across the street and starts trying to direct her to park.
Oh, boy.
And it takes him again about seven or eight more points. She finally slides in. That's what she said. The woman gets out. They actually hug each other. And then the woman who was directing her gets in the car behind where she parked and pulls out. Like, if she had just pulled out, the woman would have had two spaces in which to try to pull Carol apart. She would rather try to help out than just pull out.
That's a very great summary of American foreign policy.
I used to work audio production. We would do live concerts, and occasionally we would have women working there. We would have union hands that were female. It's always interesting to watch women move a large object. So they would, like, deliberate, discuss what they were going to do with it. Meanwhile, you see two dudes, they just grab the thing and pick it up. They intuitively know what they have to do, and they take off with it.
Any discussion of, like, how we move this object occurs with object in hand, and fine-tune adjustments are made as motion is happening.
But it's like males.
Or ultimately, if there are two tools on the ground and two men, they instinctively pick it up and it's like, okay, I'll do this part, you do that part.
Right. We intuitively know how to work as a team. Like, males are actually really good at teamwork. We're even good at looking at a situation and anticipating what needs to be done and how best to assist the other person. Women cannot do that.
Yeah. I mean, nowhere more obvious than with lifting heavy objects.
That's a really obvious one. Another
one would be time orientation, because I've actually been doing some, like, physical projects outdoors, and trying to form my vision for what it should look like. And then if I'm talking to a woman about, well, I'm like, okay, so I want this there, and I want it, the rise to that high. And she might say, well, why does it need to? And I'm like, well, because it'll block the flow of the water. Well, but it's not raining. There's no water there. It's like, it's not raining now. Things change. Or, like, you know, I want to make sure that the sun, you know, it's like, well, see, and this blocks the sun. This will be great. Well, does it block, you know, it blocks the sun now. What about in the spring when it gets hot? What do you mean? The sun's in a different place, ma'am. You know, that sort of thing. So women think differently than men in that sense.
That's one of the reasons I reject the idea of hypergamy as being like this ability of women to constantly figure out which partner is going to offer them better resources, because I don't think their brains are advanced enough to run that software. I don't think they can do those kinds of calculations.
Go on. I'm listening.
That's how much of a chauvinist I actually am, because people will say that women will evaluate their partner versus a prospective partner, and I'm like, no, they don't. They're not smart enough to do that.
I think they can do that. Another
man
picture
comes along into their life, and then, you know, they have mixed feelings, but it takes an external force or an external personality to point out the you know, relative standing of either option. Like, most often one of their friends, they're gonna say, oh,
there you go,
your man ain't shit. Like, you've been talking to Jake, he much better than your current man.
Yeah, if you get enough women, they can sort of pull their limited brain power together, and they might be able to pull off an operation like that.
Well, they have to have it, like, totally depersonalized. Like, you know, the woman in question, her friend is, you know, not dating her friend's boyfriend or the secondary man that she's interested in. So because she doesn't have any personal feelings about either man, or doesn't see herself being with either man, she can make an objective claim about the two to her, or subjective, depending on how honest she is.
Right. No, I agree.
Well, you just had a problem right there.
Honest. You suggest
a woman would be honest.
Also, I just realized, you know, everybody out there playing.
I found the problem with your equation there, Professor.
Yeah.
Everybody out there playing a rare podcast host combinations. If that's on your bingo card, the Spectre McNabb Nikkei, you know, today's your lucky day.
Dabbing on women.
Yeah.
McNabbing on women.
My entire thing with the manosphere is, like, you're giving women way too much agency and credit. Like, you're actually not being chauvinistic enough.
Well, I think what the idea of, you know, hypergamous decision making that isn't often explicated is what, you know, we just described there. It's the intervening friend's opinion that helps in the actual decision making, because one of the things that, you know, will persuade women to cheat on a relationship or change their relationship is the opinion of their friends, their peers.
Right, and their peers are always justifying whatever stupid female idea they have in their head. Like, oh yeah, you should definitely do that. Yeah, it's about you.
Right, right.
Yeah, and you know, okay, I can either play this seriously or I can play this Giga Chad. You know, I can say like, why would you let your wife or woman have a friend at all? That's why would you let her out of the house? But
the only friends the should be your offspring.
No, I'll actually give you some real, you know, life advice kind of thing. Is at no point should, once you're married, should your wife have single females friends. She does not, you know, because of, right. That's going to just create tension for you.
Generally, too.
Because like, these women are unsatisfied, they will want her to be unsatisfied,
unless
too.
Unless the majority
off.
Of the friend group is married. You can have a single female friend.
But no,
she has there has to be like a 3-to-1 ratio, 3 married to 1 single.
Dude, that's like saying you can have 1 Jew in a Congress of 100 people, and it's not going to be undermined within a week.
I don't know.
Woman
I think,
is the view of mankind. Well,
so we talked about the body of water to dead body ratio. What is the safe ratio for a friend group of married to single women?
Women don't really
none.
Have
to me, that's the bathtub right there.
I don't think they have friends the same way that men have friends.
They definitely have social circles. That's a thing.
They'll have social circles, but it's sort of like a war zone or something. They have like a temporary ally. and their allies will talk shit about the other enemy. Yeah.
Well, have you ever noticed how women can't imagine a relationship between two, you know, a relationship that's beyond casual? Between two people, that's not sexual, which right. is why, you know, they do the hermeneutics of gay suspicion for, you know, like,
is that women
any,
or is that
any
just
Chad
all
in history
parts?
Who like wrote a nice letter to a man he fought with? You know, it's like my dearest Hector, I'm, you know, I miss our days on the front, you know, that sort of thing. And oh, look at his language. Clearly, they were having butt sex. It's like, no,
I don't know if that's a
no
woman thing. That's just like a libtard thing.
I think it's both.
I think once a woman is with a right winger, she suppresses that, but it would be within her instinct if she was in the right crowd.
She'd be thinking it in the back of her mind, just not saying anything.
Yeah. Well, no, I think it would eventually, like an exercise muscle, it would atrophy.
I think the best way to understand women is to look at a young child. A young child says things like, want that. That's basically females. Want that. Don't like that. Want that. That's it.
Yeah.
There's really just not a lot going on up there. Because this is another problem with males. When we talk about women, is we use our own internal self as a frame of reference. So we look at a female behavior, and we try to understand it from the perspective of a rational, thinking, conscious male with an internal monologue. But that's not what's happening in their heads. They don't think like we do. They don't really think that much at all. They're not interested in thinking. You ever notice that? Women are not interested in thinking. They're not interested in philosophical ideas and abstractions. It's not something they find particularly engaging. They're not interested in systems, in organized systems. It's just not something that they particularly find to be a fascinating topic. So you can't use that frame of reference of yourself whenever you're analyzing their behavior.
I got a question for y'all.
Yeah.
I think I know the answer. Uh-huh. Do you ever try on clothes when you buy them? Like before you buy them?
No.
Depends.
Yeah, it is like the most... If it's like an expensive suit, obviously you're going to do it because, you know, there's a tailor in the store. They're going to fit it for you. But I'm talking about like just buying cheap clothes.
And men be like that.
Like a, you know.
What are you talking about?
I'm just saying that is like one of the, for me, that is like one of the most insufferable activities that only women in my life will insist upon. It's like, try on the clothes, and I just absolutely hate the idea. I loathe it.
Oh, man, are we doing some serious...
Okay, that's some entry-level misogyny right there.
Yeah, if you want to do like...
Sorry, it's too plush for you on a shit-posty episode.
Here's one. Are you ready to go? Yes. Okay, why are you not walking towards the car? Why is it that your concept of time becomes very fluid whenever we discuss departure times? Why is it that when a female tells me she's ready to go, it's going to be an hour before we fucking go anywhere? Why? That shit, that will drive a man insane.
Oh, yeah.
No, that is intolerable.
That's another absolutely awful one.
That's one of the worst. It's like they're all on African time, and then they'll complain about always being late. And I'm like, but you chose to always be late. Like, you made that choice. You fucking child.
I think trying on clothes is also a derivative of this, of the same phenomenon. Like, you know, for me, I don't want to do it because it takes time, and I'm shopping. I want to like minimize the time I am in a store. And, you know, I know what, you know, my size is, I know what the size of this clothing is, then I can just go to the checkout and leave.
I mean, to bring this back around to Kamala Harris, what you're going to end up with is
well, before you go there, I just want to say, hang on, before you even go there, I just want to say I had some, in my mind, brilliant point about, edgy point too, about women, but now I can't do anything but think Nikkei has been doing the women be shopping thing for going on 3 minutes now.
Can we end the show for the love of God, anyway. Please?
You're back.
Pain.
Man, you talked about a movie for like 14 like minutes, Spectre. I don't want to hear it from you.
I had no content.
Yeah, and now you're going to like get on my case about it.
Nikkei had prep. Why didn't you do Nikkei's prep?
Yeah, well, like I offered to transition into that, and then we blew past it for movies.
We were going to talk about me and Boris were going to play off each other talking about why Spurgs have very strange ideas about human relationships, but instead it just turned into chauvinism hour.
One thing I'll notice
started though as high level chauvinism, and it ended with like women be shopping. So I'm kind of disappointed in myself.
The one thing that communists, libertarians, and right wing authoritarian Spurgs have in common is they all want to debate the age of consent for some reason.
They do. They have very strange ideas.
That's not a joke. That's like not even a hyperbole. That's true.
It's startling how true it is. The thing that I had wanted to get into briefly, though, is the idea that people increasingly look at relationships as this economic transactional phenomena, and they make evaluations that way, right? And that gets you in a lot of trouble. Because regardless of all of our chauvinism, like, you are in a relationship with another human being. It's not a product. You're not buying a piece of equipment. They'll use these ideas like, if you marry a virgin, it's more likely to succeed due to this analytical, evidence-based reasoning. And I'm like, sure, on average, maybe that could possibly be true, but when you in your own life are making decisions about what kind of person you're going to be with, that's going to be a very messy, organic process. You can't apply this type of reasoning to humans, this like managerial, top-down, intellectualized approach.
Do you think things like online dating, like eHarmony, most notably, sort of enable this? I mean, because you can, by self-reported personality traits and opinions, filter out the ones that you don't want. You can do like a, you know, stat maxing optimal search partner.
I remember when that stuff started, I thought it was very creepy that algorithms were going to be helping you find a potential partner. I thought that was some very creepy shit.
Like, this is the most efficient sort of mating that's possible out there. And it's not like it's out of our reach. You can do that. And, like, it's not – it works. It's like, you know, the own self-evaluation data on such services show that it works.
I do not like instrumental reason applied to human relationships. I really hate that shit.
I want to point out something to the chat, by the way. This is why Borzoi haters are the weakest race. This shows what happens when I'm not the rudder for it. So if you have issues with today's content, this is what I have given you an abject lesson in why I'm the producer of this show.
People are going to love this show.
20 minutes, 20 fucking minutes on alongside Night or whatever that was called. Oh my god.
Yeah, we'll go that long. That's kind of zoned out.
I was just curious to see if he was going to keep going with it.
He
went.
All right, I want to do something. Nikkei, do your content.
No, stop.
We've done enough shitposting. Nikkei, do your content, please.
All right. Going back to food.
This is what you get when you demand content on a holiday weekend.
A good show.
Food posting.
This is great.
So you might have seen yesterday that the White House Twitter account put out this really awfully worded tweet. I'll read it word for word for you. Boy. Planning a cookout this year? Catch up on the news. According to the Farm Bureau, the cost of a 4th of July barbecue is down from last year. It's a fact you must turd. Hot dog, the Biden economic plan is working, and that's something we can all relish.
What?
And so they put out this GIF.
Did they fire the person who wrote this?
Probably not yet, because it was a Friday when they tweeted it. Or no, this was a Thursday, so there was time. They might have been fired.
They had to get it in before. They had to get it in for Shabbat.
Yeah,
like North Korea producing propaganda but being incompetent at it.
Well, at least North Korean propaganda is supposed to make you feel patriotic and inspired, and like you're moving, like that there's some kind of like vision of your race and future. This stuff is just it's literally like, hey, you know, at your soul crushing corporate job, hey, it's casual Friday, and here's the cute little email. And by the way, participation is mandatory.
Okay, this is like, to me, it struck me as like, you know, Soviet headlines about increases in grain production.
Yeah.
Hot dogs cheap. America, good.
And so the GIF they released is like a little slideshow. And the first slide that they give you is the cost of a 4th of July cookout in 2021 is down 16 cents from last year.
Yay. Oh, thank you, glorious leader.
So. To feed a party, right? They're talking about an entire party. Compared to when, like, there were quarantine-related halts in production across the board, across all industries, and most, like, noticeably, food production. Compared to when that was happening, you spread across, you know, a whole party's worth of people, you can save 16 cents. You know, now that we're back to working, you know, it's 16 cents cheaper to feed the entire party. So the slideshow details specific examples of how they got these figures. So 32-ounce pork and beans, $1.90, down 13% from last year. Then they go... through all these different food items, you know, ground beef, 2 pounds, 8%, half gallon ice cream, down 5%, pork chops, 2%.
Who are they trying to reach with this tweet? With this,
everybody, they literally thought this was a universally positive message.
The difference between American propaganda and Soviet propaganda, the Soviet propaganda was very like rote and we're going to tell you all this, the brutal hard facts, but don't worry, citizens, things are going to be okay. American propaganda is the same thing, but a clown that rapes your kids is the one that's delivering it to you.
Yeah.
And he tells you, hey, buckaroo, turn that frown upside down.
Is this the White House Twitter?
Yes.
I almost feel like they're just like rolling on some low-hanging fruit for Republicans to swing at.
Yeah, this kind of might be some kind of Finkel thing going on here.
Nah, I think they
look how bad the Biden.
They had a W with this one.
I don't care. I'm already dead inside.
Oh no.
All right. Well, this Google Meet thing has only got about like 10 minutes left. I'd like to quickly do this thing and get out of here because I don't know how long of a window I have with the Borsling here.
The window has 10 minutes. I have like 1 minute worth of patience left. So there you go. Let's go.
America indicted. Yes, the United States is deeply divided and probably undeserving of global leadership, as two new books argue. But who else is there? By Michael Hirsch. This is from foreignpolicy.com. It's striking that two grimly titled but very different new books about America's decline, Last Best Hope by George Packer and After the Apocalypse by Andrew Bacevich, both invoke a little-remembered 1940 Jeremiad, I always forget how it's pronounced, by the French historian Marc Bloch called Strange Defeat. In that short book, published a few years before its author was killed by the Gestapo, Bloch indicted his own people for cultural decadence and societal disintegration, leading to France's subjugation by the Nazis. Both Packer, a staff writer at The Atlantic and a National Book Award-winning author, and Bacevich, a historian and retired career U.S. Army officer, believe Bloch's indictment of France is relevant to what the United States faces today. Like France in 1940, America in 2020 stunned itself with a collapse that was larger and deeper than one leader, Packer writes, referring to Washington's often incompetent response to COVID-19. Under invasion and occupation, few of our institutions held up. Bacevich, too, suggests that for different reasons, the United States is in a position analogous to that of defeated France in 1940, suffering a total collapse of leadership and vision. My purpose in writing After the Apocalypse compares with Bloch's, he writes. Whoa, is the United States really that far gone? After all, we don't see anything like the Wehrmacht goose-stepping up Pennsylvania Avenue. Not even close. Rather than leaving the nation's future to a collaborator like Philippe Pétain, Americans have managed to elect Joe Biden, a fundamentally decent guy who is proving nearly every day that he is not Donald Trump. Biden received a record 81 million votes and promptly began undoing Trump's worst depredations. True, more than 620,000 Americans have died of COVID-19, far too many unnecessarily, but the pandemic is hardly comparable to the Nazi occupation, much less the Holocaust. And for all America's failings, the country still seems to be the cleanest dirty shirt in the global laundry compared with China's aggressive debt colonizing and Russia's various pretensions to influence. There really is, even now, no alternative ideological model to freedom, and the United States remains by far the most powerful free nation on Earth, like it or lump it. You guys have any comments so far?
There's a lot to unpack there.
Yeah.
There's a lot to unpack. So what murdered the United States? It looks like it was the United States.
Yes.
It was suicide.
I mean, these other countries that he gives examples of, it's like they suffered a war. They were like defeated. Or they were in some kind of massive conflict, but not the United States. The United States just killed itself.
Yeah. The United States, hit the ground when it was born and has been crawling towards its own grave ever since. Yeah. Just, for some reason, picking up speed.
So, yeah, and I'm going to skip ahead. Go ahead.
Do we need a global leader?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the question right there. Why is a global leader, you know, necessary? Leading towards what? Freedom and democracy? Well, I mean, we're living in the consequences of that.
Yeah, well, the country I'm hearing that is disintegrated.
I can think of a global leader I would like.
I'm going to skip ahead a little bit here, because basically what this article is fundamentally about is that there is no answer to this, because, I mean, like the answers, I mean, we have the answers, but these people don't have any answers. There's nothing that's going to work. Collapse. Atomized We Are Becoming. Packers is the better book, brilliantly diagnosing this American illness in stinging, crisp prose that spares neither the right nor the left on the widening political spectrum. That is the greatest virtue of Last Best Hope. It's even-handedness and intellectual honesty. Packer breaks down the problem into narratives of four Americas, two each on the right and left. The right has on its side the free America of libertarian ideals and the real America of white Christian nationalism. The left is now defined by the smart America of meritocratic elites and the just America of the woke progressives. I don't much want to live in the republic of any of them, Packer writes, often delivering scintillating epigrams to make his point. For example, just America's coercive tactics, dubbed cancel culture by some, remind me of left-wing ideology in the 1930s, Packer writes. Woke aesthetics is the new socialist realism. But Packer's solutions are sometimes disappointing. If only the four Americas could get to know each other better, he writes, by killing their Twitter or Facebook accounts and spending time in the physical presence of other Americans who don't look or talk or think like them. So
I think we're already at that point, and we didn't like what we saw.
And nobody asked us if we wanted it in the first place.
Yeah, first of all, we weren't asked. Second of all, well, we tried it, and we hate it.
Yeah. Third of all, it's failing. Fourth of all, you're putting more money into the shit show every year because you know it's failing. I mean, if this was the unalloyed good, this global homo diversity thing that they want, why would they have to? Why would diversity compliance become, you know, a growing industry the way it has? It seems like it would be a built into the cake would be that it would be a dying industry.
The cope is real diversity has never been tried, as like we're living through real diversity.
Real diversity. Your pod is a different color than the pod next to you.
Nice.
All pods are the same color on the inside, though. They only paint the outside.
Yeah. I want to get out of here, so I'm going to read the last two paragraphs. And basically, fundamentally, it just shows how intellectually bankrupt these people are, and that they have to deal with the fact that they are a decadent and declining elite. The only possible solution is a national Venn diagram in which Americans can create enough overlap between the four Americas to overcome the differences. This would, as Packer says, serve to make America again, and allow for a rebirth of national identity, affirming that Abraham Lincoln's mystic chords of memory endure. Perhaps this could lead to some kind of new consensus about the appropriate balance between a globally engaged America and an inwardly focused one. As Ben Rhodes, Barack Obama's former senior aide, writes in his own new book, Reckoning with the Problems of America After the Fall, to have any capacity to help fix what has gone wrong in the world, we have to begin fixing what has gone wrong with ourselves. Biden, to his credit, is trying to accomplish this, to end this uncivil war that pits red against blue, as he said in his inaugural address. A son of the working class, he is trying to restore it, and as someone who has seen and often been part of the best and worst of U.S. intervention around the world for five decades, he seems to be trying to strike the proper balance between national interest and overreach. Succeed or fail, Biden could decide a great deal. Now, we know that's not true. What I will end on is this, and this, I want to do a broader topic about kind of everyone's sense of the end of America, and unfortunately I wasn't really able to do much of that, but I will say this. I get the feel, we are reaching an inflection point where more and more Americans, like, yes, 4th of July has already become a grilling holiday, but they feel no feelings about the United States of America. But do you know what they do have feelings about? When they see statues of Breonna Taylor and George Floyd getting desecrated, they feel very good about that. And that's a place where, as an elite, you don't want to be.
Damn. Yeah, let's end on that. I guess I want to thank Alex McNabb for coming in, sitting with us on this gorgeous... What is this? The day before
Independence Day? Yes, it's the day before Independence
Day. The American system?
Yep.
Independence.
The day before Independence.
What even is Independence? Come on now.
It's like, do you have a study about that? Do you have a study about Independence Day?
Yeah. Alex, you got anything you want to plug? Aside from the obvious?
What's the obvious?
Oh. Well, the Daily Show.
No, I was going to say the obvious is I'm going to be posting a baby registry sometime soon.
Oh, really?
Nice. I'll plug that. I don't have it up yet, but that'll be there. Everybody else knows where to find me, like on the other show. And then I write stuff on Dissident Mag periodically.
Yeah, that's one of some of my favorite stuff that you put out. In fact, we plugged in every week because of that.
Sometimes I don't get a point out on Tedious, which I know is hard to imagine, and I just write the stuff down and put it there.
Why? Is somebody else talking?
Yeah, I don't know. Occasionally, the conversations, like, somebody just kind of dominates them, and yeah, it's the thing that happens.
That's our Sven.
It is. I know Sven is really bad about that. He just talks about guitar pedals for like hours at a time.
Let me think. I'll tell you something offline afterwards. I can't risk any private information getting out, but it's kind of funny. But Borzoi, what do you want to plug, sir?
Well, if you have a paywall subscription, you probably already know that I was on the last episode of Tedious, and I was there in person. I was actually in the studio for that one. You don't get to see me. Sorry about that, but I was on that show. It was a good one.
If you actually look in the mirror that's on the wall, yeah, you can actually see your reflection real plainly. I didn't know you weren't supposed to be seen. I already told you that before it aired. Is that going to be a problem?
Yeah, sure. Marty Plays the Sims and of Marty Book fame, Let Them Look West. I am two chapters in right now. Very good book. Highly recommended. I am going to be doing a hyper podcastism with Marty, Nikkei, and a special guest who was, well, I'll just say it, Mike wants to do an episode as well. He's been champing at the bit to talk about Marty's book, so I'm setting up a podcast so we can talk to him about it. So I'm going to try to record that next week.
Okay, so my book is on the way from antelopehillpublishing.com. Check that place out, guys.
Is it released yet, or have they announced it?
Well, no, I ordered it. I don't know if it's out.
Oh, no, I was talking about your book. I was talking about your book.
No, I'm talking about Marty's book. I'm still talking about Marty. I'm not plugging my shit.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not antelope shill like you are.
And just remember, you are not allowed to listen to this podcast if you do not watch Marty Plays the Sims or have Marty book.
The stakes have been risen.
Okay, so I heard y'all talking about this for a couple of weeks. I've been really busy. Hadn't had much time to consume content. Finally got around to it, and I watched the first couple, and I'm like, okay, I really don't want to be out of touch here. I don't want to be the guy who's, you know, out of the loop. I'm not getting it, though, the first couple episodes. I mean, I thought there were a few amusing points, but what even is this, right?
Just keep watching.
Hang on. I got to episode 7, and there's no spoilers here, but when he announces that he's going to plan to kill Mortimer, that's when my ears perked up, and that's when the whole thing just, I mean, it just skyrockets. I'm not saying that the first couple episodes weren't amusing. You needed it. You needed your world building. You need to understand what the program was here. And there were some very amusing moments. It just, at the time, it wasn't hooking me the way you guys were so gung-ho about it. And, yeah, I was up till, like, 3 a.m. today trying to finish off the entire series.
Yeah.
And I've ordered his book as well.
For people who are skeptical about the series, because I know there's people that have watched the first episode and don't get what the big deal is, you have to keep, just trust us, it gets really, really good right around the, Mortimer stuff.
Double overlapping. Yeah. I was doing the Borzoi laugh. By the episode 7 and 8.
Just trust us. If the first couple episodes might be a little bit slow because you got to get into the pace of it. Once you get the Mortimer arc starts, you will be on board. It is that good.
And these episodes are only like 10, 12 minutes each. So it's not like you're wasting a whole lot of time. And if you really get grug, if you're really grug brained like me, if you just absolutely insist, you can scrub ahead.
All right. Well, I know we got to rush, but I don't want to forget about Nikkei before we head out. Nikkei, what do you got?
Yes, big announcement. I will be featured in an upcoming Antelope Hill publication, Why We Fight essay contest. I submitted my speech, and it'll be featured in the book. Check that out upon release. You can F5 gang that for days. That'll be coming out sometime this month. Also, I was in a debate this week with a anarcho-syndicalist on the Grillcast. Find it on YouTube. Their latest episode. Link will be in the description.
Yeah, I'll add it to the notes. All right. Well, if that's it, Spectre, can you take us out, please? Spectre, I'm sorry. Just go and they call. We have a minute now. Do the outro right now.
Oh shit. Yeah. Nikkei is on the Young Whites on TRS Radio Network. Get behind the rightstuff.biz paywall. At therightstuff.biz/paywall. That's it for this week. Happy birthday, Pig American System. Hope this is like your very own 476 AD. History fans will get that one. Mr. Producer, hail victory. See ya, Kyle. Also, thanks to live listeners.
I'm gonna go get some.
We'll be right back.